So let's summarize what we did last time before I tell you what we are going to do today. And so last time, in our second lecture, we said, let's start studying in great detail what might be the simplest statistical mechanical model, where the space of configurations is very easy to describe. Just we have a spin at each side of a spin chain. And that spin can be plus one, which is up, or minus one, which is down. So that's the configurations. We just have L spins, and they can be plus one or minus one. So there are two to the L configurations. The simplest Ising model we could consider is without magnetic field and just spin I coupled to spin I plus one. So that's the same as saying that we sum over neighbors I and j, but we are in one dimension, so the neighbors is just I and I plus one. That coupling j is the dimensionless product of the inverse temperature with a coupling between spins, right? Normally to the pure e to the minus beta h. So that j there would be coming from minus beta times the coupling of the spins. Now, the first, it was very convenient to understand that this exponential here only takes two values, right? E to the j and e to the minus j. So we can trade it for any function that also only takes two values. It's the same thing. In particular, this one is very convenient, where I write that term there as 1 plus v times something. So this is 1 plus v or 1 minus v, depending on whether this product is 1 or minus 1. And by matching v to that exponential, this becomes an equality. Now v then becomes tangent of beta times j, or tangent of this dimensionless j. And this is just an equality. Now let's look at this, for this link between site I and I plus 1, when I think I have this product, I can associate this 1 to an empty connection. And I can associate this term to a stick, to a full connection. And then immediately you see that if I open up this parenthesis, for each link, I either put a stick or don't put a stick, right? So immediately I get some normalization and then a sum, where now the configuration space changed. Instead of being a spin plus or minus one at each side, now at each link, I either put nothing or I put a connection, or I put a stick, right? And then I have a weight for each configuration, where I have empty or stick, right? And what's the weight for this configuration? This weight, it's zero if there are open ends. Because whenever there was an open end, it means that there is an odd number of spins, but the sum over plus minus one of an odd function of spin gives zero, right? It's one minus one, it's zero. What if there are no open ends? If there are no open ends, it means that the summand is just 1, because it's S2 square, S4 square, for example, no S6. So it is just 1 when I have an even power of spins. And I normalized it. I put some 1 over 2 to the L here. There are L spin chains and sides. So the sum just gives 1, except that there is a V for each side. So that gives V to the number of sticks if there are no open ends, right? Now, how could there be no open ends? Well, the only option is everyone is empty or everyone is full, right? But everyone is full, V is tangent, is between 0 and 1, so this number is much smaller than this one. Any question here? All good? Now, we also saw that this same partition function, when I'm here, I could do something interesting, which is I could get rid of half of the sites and go from L to L prime, which is L over 2, by explicitly doing the sum over the even spins, such that at the end, in my configurations, I only have the odd spins. Now, what happens here? Well, when I do the sum over an even spin, I have, say, S1 with S2, and then S2 with S3, and then I get rid of S2, right? And what can happen is that I can have the 1 with the 1 survives, the V with the V survives, but the other terms have an odd number of S2, they don't survive. And so the only thing that I get is 1 or V times V, which is V squared. So after I integrate out the second spin, I end up with the same type of system, but now the coupling V became V squared. V prime is just V squared.
So we are integrating the even spin.
Yeah.
Integrating out. So if you're doing coarse grinding, would it make more sense to replace like a pair of odd and even spin by something else?
Yeah.
Rather than just integrating?
Morally speaking, it's the same. So what Tibor is saying is why there are many ways of zooming out. One way of zooming out is losing degrees of freedom because we zoom out, so we get rid of spin two. Another one is grouping each two spins and trying to replace it by one spin because we zoom out and we only see one. Or we could do it three spins at a time. So there are many ways of zooming out. And it's like a normalization scheme. It's what you choose. It's our choice. So we choose to just zoom out and we lose information about half of the degrees of freedom and see what remains as I zoom out.
And the answer is independent of...
Yeah, the physics at large distances must be independent. Now here, you see that now we have our coupling, which is just V squared. Right? So, and this already gives us some hints, because it means that the same physical system, right, I get exactly the same model, and if I go to large distances, right, if I want to compute the correlation function, say, between a point and a point at a distance 1 million, I could very well integrate out degrees of freedom, and I only care about very large distances. And therefore, I should be able to study to ignore the details and do this coarse graining, say, 10 times. And each time I do it, the coupling goes to V squared. Right? And so this should give me some information about the large distance physics. Okay? So for example, if I start with some coupling V, what happens? I start with some coupling. This is V prime equal V squared. This is V. And so if I start with some coupling, I go here. Right? Now I am at some new V prime. Right? So this V prime is this V prime. If I project into this line, this is the line V prime equal V. It tells me that I went from this V initial, V zero, to this V one, which is V zero square, right? I just went to the parabola and then project back here. Do you agree? Is it okay? Right? So this is just the same as this. And therefore, right, so we are here. And now if I apply a second time, it means that I go here. And so I could consecutively go like this, like this, like this. So if we, this is just the geometrical way of understanding that if I apply V square many times, I eventually go to zero if I start with a number between 0 and 1. Right? So if I start with 0.7, 0.7 square many times, I end up going to zero. And so we have this picture where I start V zero, I go here, then I start from this value, I go here, I start from this value, I go there, I start from this value, I go there, and so on. And so we see that there is a stable fixed point. This would be what's called the renormalization group flow picture, where this 0 and this is 1, these are the possible values of V, and any value I take, what we say is it flows, so at large distances, it effectively behaves as if the coupling was V equals 0. So this is stable. At large distances, it looks as if I'm always describing a system which has a V effectively zero. And this one is unstable because to be here, it's a fixed point as well, because if V is 1, V1 squared is still 1. But any small deformation, any 0.99, immediately goes back to zero, right? And V, strictly speaking, is tangent of X, can never be 1. It can only be 1 if this J was infinite. Right? So asymptotically, it can be very close to 1, but eventually it zooms up. So it's inaccessible. This point is unstable. It would be only achieved if J was equal to infinity, which doesn't exist. What exists is J going to infinity. So it's, and this J going to infinity, remember, corresponds to T equal to 0, to inverse temperature, to temperature equal to 0, because beta is equal to infinity. So if it was really 0 temperature, fine, then V would be equal to 1, then it behaves as if V equal to 1. But for any finite temperature, it flows to a point that would correspond to J equal to 0, or beta equal to infinity, or t equal to infinity, which means disorder. We have infinite temperature and things are disordered, and indeed, in the one-dimensional model, we have no order. Okay, so that's a very simple picture that would describe that simple equation there. And again, by these arrows, what we mean is these arrows stand for going to large distances. Going to large distances, which is what we say when we follow the RG and we study low energy. Now, let's try to, so this is just a cartoon. And we also saw that we could do a computation where we see these things kind of more explicitly. For example, we could compute what's the correlation function between spin at position I and spin at position I plus R. That's just this average, right? That amounts to taking these spins and putting it here, right? Si and Si plus R. And now, if I put it here, Si and Si plus R, by the same logic, I get the same sum over configurations of sticks. But now there's already an Si and an Si plus R. So if I want an even number of Si and Si plus R, it means that the sticks better have open ends there, because there's already a spin there, so I want an open end. So it's exactly the same thing as before, except that now I get z to the number of sticks if Si and Sr are the only open ends, and zero otherwise. Namely, if there are other open ends or if there are no open ends. Okay? And therefore, there are two configurations. Either I connect I and I plus R by v, by sticks, or I go the other way around on the spin chain, so I get V to the R or V to the L minus R, right? Going directly or going the other way around. And like in the partition function, if L is very big, this term is much bigger than this, like the one was much bigger than V to the L, so the result is just V to the R, where R is the separation. In other words, it decays exponentially. It's exponential of minus R over some typical length scale, where this typical length scale is minus 1 over log V. That we could compute exactly here. Do you agree? Now, remember how we could find this result without doing this explicit simple computation, but more from an RG point of view. We would say, I don't know what is my correlation length. So this is a correlation length. Right? And I don't know what this correlation length is, but I would say that my correlation length at V is related by my correlation length at V square in the following way. I would say this is a number of sites, how many sites there are. Suppose that the correlation length would be 100 sites, right? Then 100 sites after I coarse grain become 50 sites, right? And therefore, there should be a relation like this. My, whatever my correlation is, length is, when I coarse grain, the coupling goes from V to V square. And I get half the size, so the correlation length that I add is twice the new correlation length. Because, right, I have a typical length scale, it's from here to here. Before that was 100 units, 100 sites. Now I coarse grain, it's just 50 sites. Right? And this equation, the solution to this equation, is that psi is a constant divided by log V, and there, and that matches precisely with what with the computation we just did there. Right? And in particular, we see that this computation, this result here, it goes, when R goes to infinity, it goes to zero, right? Which means that zero is equal, when the distance is very large, the spin I and spin I plus R don't know about each other, so it should also become the product of the two, right? Do you agree? And this is, on the other hand, nothing but length square times the magnetization square, where the magnetization would be 1 over the length times the average of the spin at position I, because that would be translation invariant, right? And so, in particular, we are saying that this magnetization is equal to zero. And I want to emphasize that this magnetization is equal to zero, although the energy for all spins up is bigger, is smaller than the energy for other configurations, say. Where I have a few spins down, right? So naively, I would say that's the low energy configuration. So at least when the temperature is small, when the system is very cold, right? Why doesn't it just go to the vacuum, which is like all spins up? That's the lowest energy state, right? And the answer is that this thing, which would be ordered, is destroyed because it's very easy to destroy, to increase the energy by a little bit only, and increase the entropy by a lot, right? And therefore, it is advantageous to destroy this order. So in equations, we would say that this sum over configurations, it's always a competition between two terms, right? So we are summing over exponential of minus beta times the energy of my configuration times the number of terms that we write, logarithm of the number of terms with that given energy, and this is what we call the entropy at a given energy. And so this is dominated by an equilibrium. On the one hand, we don't want large energies, that's suppressed, but on the other hand, we want large entropy. So there is a competition, right? So these guys, they compete with each other. So they compete, right? And these partition functions are dominated by e to the minus some equilibrium energy, which comes precisely from this competition between these two effects. And what configurations, what was happening? What was happening? We had all these spins up. But what we could do is we could easily go from all spins up and we could flip and create some domain with spins down. Now you see that here, the energy here is equal to the energy here, right? In both cases, it's just all spins are aligned. And so the only difference is these small walls. At these small walls, there is an energy cost. And these small walls, these domain walls, these are domain walls that separate two domains. Domain walls, or we can call them kinks. Okay? So they become like some excitations that separate spin up from spin down. And what's happening is that, you see, I create two of these excitations. And this kink anti-kink excitation, they do increase the energy. There is some extra energy at the barriers. But there are so many places to put that they generate a big entropy. So it wins in that sum. And therefore, what the words we say is that these excitations destroy order. So we say these kinks, we blame on them. We say that they destroy magnetic order. Okay. Good. Okay, so this was a summary of what we saw last time. And oh my God.
Yeah, that's broken.
Really? Okay. Okay. Any question about last time? Yes.
I have two questions. First, I really didn't get the open end point. So,
sorry, you did not get what?
I didn't get why it has to be zero if there are open ends. Can you just go over it once more?
Here? Why this weight is zero if there are open ends? This is the idea that if there are open ends, right, for example, here, it means if there exists open ends, it means that there will be a sum over a spin of that open end of the spin of that open end, right? But this is a sum over plus minus one, so this is it. So just the fact that there is an open end means that that spin there at the open end is alone. And we sum over plus minus one of some s, it's zero. In fact, it would be zero if I put here any odd number, right? Any other question?
Yeah, so what do we expect here? Do we expect that all of them will be completely anti-aligned with each other? So like one up, the next one should be down, the next one should be up, because that would kind of maximize.
No, we just expect that they are uncorrelated. We just expect that the spin I doesn't care about the next spin. Okay. Right? The fact that the coupling is going to zero is like saying they don't care about each other. They don't care about the next one. Okay? Any other question? Okay. So today the plan is, one, we will finish the 1D Ising. And in particular, we will add magnetic field and see how all this physics discussion changes. And second, we will present some spoilers / motivation for some random walks. Let me, before moving on, just point out that if I call this stuff here partition function of sticks, that's already kind of a trivial duality that we are saying. We are saying that there is two models, one this random model of sticks, and one the one-dimensionalizing model, and they are the same. They're just description of the same thing, right? One could be a model like I have some water and I have some sticks whose endpoints are hydrophobic, and I just drop them on water and they want to not to have open ends, right? So, and that would be a model of sticks, for example, right? And the other is the Ising model, where I have spins up and minus one. And we see they are describing the same thing. So two very different physical, a priori, they look different, but they are the same thing. So there is a duality between this model of sticks and that model of Ising. And the model of sticks, because we have this business of having no open ends, or having maybe two open ends between I and I plus R, it's also a model of walks. It is just that the walks are too trivial, because the only walks that you can do in one dimension without open ends, either I do nothing or I go around, right? It's like walks around the lake. I mean, what can you do? You can go around or do nothing, right? And if you have 2 points and you have to go from one to the other, you either go or go around the lake in the other direction, and that's it, right? So it's also a partition function of walks. It is just that the walks, because it's in a line, they're not that rich, right? Okay, good. Some spoilers, motivation, random walks from Ising when we go back to Ising in D bigger than one. Okay, but first we start with one. Okay, so we want to add magnetic field. So what we are going to study now is the Ising model with magnetic field in one dimension, which is just the sum over each spin, which is plus minus one. But now the difference is that we have a sum over I plus one, but we also have a magnetic field that measures the magnetization at position SI. Okay. Now, here, yes, last time we used fancy RG arguments, right? And then we solved the model. Now let me do the opposite. Let's first solve the model and then reproduce the explicit results using some RG arguments, right? But that's what we are going to do. So let's solve this model by noting that this model is equal to the following. If I think of this object here. Let's think of this object. Let's construct a matrix here whose entries are Si equal plus one and Si equal minus one, and here Si plus one equal to plus 1 and Si plus 1 equal to minus 1. And so this exponential is equal, if both are 1, is equal to e to the j plus h. If both are minus 1, is e to the j minus h. Sorry. Yeah. Let me write the following. So the first thing I'll do, let me write this. Si plus sum of Si plus 1, like this, and put here over 2. So it is just, it's exactly the same thing. I did nothing here, but I just made the weight more, I distributed evenly I and I plus 1, right? But this is nothing, right? This I did nothing. Now, when both are 1, as I said, it's what I wrote there. When both are minus 1, it's this. And now if 1 is 1 and 1 is minus 1, this term here is 0. So we get e to the minus j, e to the minus j. Right? So this matrix, you look at this matrix, it tells you the interaction between I and I plus 1. Do you agree? And what are we doing here? We are taking these weights for 1, 2, 2, 3, 3, 4, 4, 5, 5, 6. And we are summing over the intermediate, over each spin, which means we are multiplying these matrices. Do you agree? So this is equal, if I call this matrix T, then this object, I'm just taking T for 1, 2, multiplying by T, multiplying by T, tac, 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 tac. And at the end, I multiply the first with the last one, which means I take the trace. So this is just equal to the trace of this matrix to the power of the number of connections. This matrix is called the transfer matrix. And what it's doing, it's increasing the size of my spin chain. It's telling me if I know my spin chain here, then this addition of this spin is obtained by summing over the spins here, which means sum over these spins that appear here, that is equivalent to multiplying by an extra transfer matrix. Adding an extra transfer matrix each time you want to add an extra spin. Okay? Right? So again, we are interpreting this sum as just, this is the matrix. Right, this is a transfer matrix whose indices are Si and Si plus 1. And the fact that I just multiply and sum over the indices means I'm just multiplying this matrix. Is it clear? Yeah? Yes.
Can you explain the picture again, what you were saying about this? Just this last thing you said.
Yeah, I'm just saying that, right. So, let's draw again. So we are saying that when I have two spins, spin I and I plus 1, right? That I think of this as a matrix T whose index is Si and Si plus 1. Now let's do three spins where I have I plus 1, and I plus 2. Right? What should I do? I should write T, whose index is Si, Si plus 1. I should write another T, whose index is Si plus 1, Si plus 2. Right? And what do? I sum over this guy, right? We sum over everyone. So in particular, we sum over this guy. So summing over this is multiplication of matrices, right? It's A, B, B, C, and we sum over B. So this is nothing but the product of the two matrices, elements Si, Si plus 2.
Okay.
Right? And each time I'm adding a new spin, I'm adding an extra product with a matrix, right? That's what I meant, try to mean by this picture. Any question here?
Why are we tracing over it as well?
Sorry?
Why are we tracing over?
Why do we trace? This is a trace. This is a 2x2 matrix. I take the trace of the 2x2 matrix. Why? Because I'm multi. like I put this, I multiply the two. If I put an extra one, I multiply, multiply, multiply. But at the end, spin L couples to spin one. So I have to, that index, right, connects back to the first one, so it's a trace. Right? Is it clear to everyone? Right? It is just the last connection, right? If this is spin one, and if this is spin L, right, I have one with two, two with three, and so on, and at the end, L back with one again, it's taking a trace. Okay, so you see how nice it is that we just solved the partition function. We just said, here is a 2x2 matrix, multiply it L times, and take the trace. That's it. That's the solution of the Eisenman. Now, it's still not totally trivial, because you can take this as this matrix and you can multiply it. It's fine. You can multiply it 2 times, 3 times, 4 times. But if you want to multiply it arbitrary number of times, the clever thing to do is to say that this is just equal to whatever is the eigenvalues. Let's suppose we have 2 eigenvalues. It's just lambda plus to the L plus lambda minus to the L, where these are the eigenvalues of the matrix T. Right? These are the eigenvalue of T. Right? If you want me to do a bit slower, let's do it a bit slower. Because what I'm saying is that trace of T to the L is what? It's trace of matrix T. The matrix T is lambda plus lambda minus 0, 0. That's the eigenvalues. After I diagonalize, so there is a matrix U and U minus 1. This is nothing but T. Here I'm writing T. And I have to do it L times. So let's do it L times. I put U minus 1. Again, lambda plus lambda minus 0, 0. U. And so on. Right? And I do it L times. And you see that what happens is that this is nothing. It's just the identity. Here is just the identity. And at the very end, there is a U matrix that combines with that one using cyclicity that also gives the identity. So I get trace of just a product of diagonal matrices, lambda plus, lambda minus, lambda plus, lambda minus. Right? But this is just equal to the trace. This product now is trivial to do, lambda plus to the L, lambda minus to the L. And that is just the sum of the two elements, lambda plus to the L, plus lambda minus to the L. Okay. So if we know the eigenvalues of T, we know very well how to compute this trace. So let's compute the eigenvalues of T. Well, the eigenvalues of T, it's a 2x2 matrix. So I just compute the characteristic determinant. So I get E to the J plus H minus lambda, E to the J minus H minus lambda, minus E to the minus 2J equal to 0. Right? And so I get 2 eigenvalues. Lambda, it's a quadratic equation. So I have 2 eigenvalues, lambda plus minus equal. E to the J plus H plus E to the J minus H. And then plus of minus square root of B square minus 4AC. So B square would be this. E to the J plus H plus E to the J minus H square minus 4 this times this, it's E to the 2J minus e to the minus 2 j. Is this correct?
Yes.
Okay. You ready? Let's do a check. What is this equal to when h equal to 0? Well, when h equal to 0, we get h is 0, so we get 2 e to the j here. We square, we get 4 e to the j. It cancels this, so I only get this. I take out the square root, so I get 2 e to the minus j. And here I get 2 e to the j. So in total, we get 2 e to the j plus e to the minus j. In other words, we get, 2 times e to the j plus e to the minus j. Plus or minus. You ready? And so we get that this is so we get that lambda plus is equal to cosh j and lambda minus is equal to sinh j. And therefore, in this case, z would be equal to cosh j to the L. That's the biggest eigenvalue, so it's actually the dominant one. So because it's the dominant one, let me actually factor it out and write 1 plus, and now this sinh of j to the L, it's just v to the L, right? Because now I get sinh over cosh. Okay? And this 1 plus v to the L is indeed what we said the result should be. Okay? Is it good? Okay, so looks like we are in business. So let's maybe do another check to see that we did not do a mistake. So this is a check with h equal to 0, right? So this is check, right? We check that this was what we derived the other day. Let's do another check. What is this when j equal to 0 instead? Let's check that we are getting results that make sense. When j equal to 0, this term cancels this term. J equal to 0, this square cancels the square root. And then when j equal to 0, this becomes either equal to the square root, or the square root either cancels or doubles. So the eigenvalues become this, that is 2 or 2 times e to the h plus e to the minus h. These are the two eigenvalues that we get. Sorry, this is lambda plus minus. So in other words, there is a 2 there. So lambda plus equal to 1 and lambda minus equal, or lambda minus equal to 1. This should be swapped if I want to say this is plus and minus. Lambda minus equal to 1 and lambda plus equal to 2 cosh of h.
Why lambda minus equals to 1 instead of 0?
Yeah, sorry. Should be 0, good. So lambda minus equal to 0. Lambda plus equal cosh of h. Yeah.
Also, everywhere there's a missing factor of 2. Cosh h is eh plus e minus h over 2. So, but that is doesn't matter. Lambda plus should be 4 cos h.
No. That's 2 times lambda plus, right? So the 2 cancels the 2.
Oh, yes. Sorry.
Right?
Yeah.
And so the partition function here, partition function, becomes just 2 cos h, which I'm going to write again as e to the h plus e to the minus h again. I don't know why I wrote it as cos, to the power l, right? Which means that, which looks like a partition function of l decoupled spins, right? Where each, the Hamiltonian is e to the h times s, and therefore the energy is e to the h and e to the minus h. But that's exactly what it is. When j equal to 0, I just have l decoupled spins. Each can be 1 or minus 1. So that also works, right? So we get l decoupled spins, right? With energy, which is just h times the spin. So it can be plus 1 or minus 1, and we get l of them. So it's just z is just z of 1 to the power l. They are totally independent. Okay, so the two limits work. H equal to 0, j equal to 0, it works. We probably did no mistake. Yes? Okay, but now what I want to point out here is that z for general j and h is approximately equal to lambda plus to the l, since lambda plus is bigger than lambda minus. So it's like before. And this would be the solution to the Ising model with magnetic field. That's the partition function of the Ising model with magnetic field. It's lambda plus to the L, where lambda plus is given by the expression that I wrote there. Okay. Now, let me tell you or remind you, because I assume many people already saw this 1D Ising model in great detail, but let me tell you, how would we go about in this language computing these things like what is the expectation value of Si, Si plus R? Or what's the expectation value of just Si? Right? Things like this. Well, how do we do? What does it mean? It means that I just have my product of matrices, but that's some in the middle of my product. I have Ti plus 1, Ti plus 1, I plus 2, and so on. In the middle of the product, I insert these spins, right? So let's see what is happening here. So this spin, for example, here, I add the matrix T, Si minus 1, Si. Then I insert this Si, and then I add T, Si, Si plus 1, T, Si plus 1, Si plus 2, dot, 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 until I reach that last one. Okay, and here I sum over all spins. So I sum over this spin. Right? So now this does not look like matrix multiplication. I don't have TAB times TBC. I have the index appearing 3 times. That's not matrix multiplication, right? Okay, but that's easy to fix. So I just say that this, I just put a prime here, right? And I say that there is delta Si, Si prime, and I sum now over Si, over Si, and over Si prime. And you see I'm putting two arrows to indicate that Si appears now once here and once here, and Si prime appears once here and once here. Right? So if I say that this is my matrix spin, where my matrix spin is just a matrix, diagonal matrix with 1 minus 1, then what I have here is just T dot the matrix spin dot T dot, etc. That's what is written down here. Okay, and so we immediately conclude that these objects are very easy to compute in terms of just insert these matrices. So for example, this one would be trace of T to the I minus 1, but then at position I insert this S matrix, and then T to the remaining L minus I plus 1 matrix. Right? that's what this object would be, right? Or more precisely, it's this divided by the partition function to normalize it. And this one would be just the same thing, trace t to the I minus 1 s t to the r s t to the remaining ones l minus I minus r plus divided by the partition function. Okay? Okay, good. Now, this in particular means the following. Means that this object here, let me write this, let's start by looking at the two-point function, because the two-point function, we have some experience. And let's look at this two-point function here and rewrite this trace as saying that this is trace s t to the r s t to the l minus r. And all I did here was rotate these t's to the end using cyclicity of the trace. Right? Now, this trace means that I sum over all states, right? I sum over all states, so let's write this explicitly. So this can be the state corresponding to plus, to eigenvalue plus, dot, 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 plus, plus the state corresponding to eigenvalue minus, dot, 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 minus, where dot, dot, dot is what is inside the trace. You agree? I'm just tracing, so I'm summing over the two. I can trace in any basis. This is the eigenvector associated to lambda plus. This is the eigenvector associated to lambda minus. Right? Now, this is why I put this guy here. Because you see that when I act with lambda plus, each time I act with the transfer matrix, I get the power of lambda plus. So this term here is proportional to lambda plus to the L minus R. This is equal to lambda plus here, and then I get plus, and now the spin matrix S T to the R, the spin matrix, and then plus again. And this one here, it's exactly the same thing, just replace plus by minus. Right? But now, remember that lambda plus is much bigger than lambda minus. Lambda plus to the L, lambda plus is bigger than lambda minus. So lambda plus to the L minus R is much bigger than lambda minus to the L minus R. Right? So this term here is subleading. Right? Because this lambda minus is smaller than lambda plus. So when I raise it to a big power, that one is huge compared to this one. Right? And therefore, I conclude that this object is equal to lambda plus to the L minus R times the expectation value of eigenvalue plus S T to the R S eigenvalue plus divided by the partition function, which itself is approximately equal to lambda plus to the L. Okay? Okay. And therefore, let's continue. This expectation value, we are computing the correlation function between spin I and spin I plus R in this transfer matrix language, is equal to lambda plus to the minus R times the expectation value plus S T to the R S with plus. And by the way, let me write immediately also what would be if I just add SI, right? Spin at position I. By the same logic, it would be just the expectation value of plus S plus. Do you agree? Yeah? Good. Now, let's go on. And notice that what is happening here. So here now, I act with, let's insert here the identity in this place as the resolution of the identity plus and minus. Right? And then you see what happens. So let's call this the magnetization, right? So this would be the magnetization. And then we see that when we insert this term, what happens when I get this plus here? When I get this plus, look, plus acting on T gives lambda plus to the R times plus again. And so I get what from the plus term? Lambda plus to the R cancels this lambda plus to the minus R. And what do I get? Right, so I plug this guy here, what happens to this full result? M square, right? You see? Lambda plus cancels with lambda plus, and then it becomes exactly the square of this. So it becomes M square. That's from this term here. And then from this term, I get plus, well, this term would give me the absolute value of S plus S minus square. Right, because it gives the cat times the conjugate, times lambda minus over lambda plus to the R. And so we conclude that this object, right, behaves as when R goes to infinity, you see, it goes to the decoupled case, M square, right? So this is equal to M square plus some constant, this thing here, e to the minus R over xi, where xi is just minus, or the inverse of xi is minus the logarithm of lambda plus, of lambda minus over lambda plus. And so, when R goes to infinity, this just goes to M square, where M is given by this. Good. And now let's see, what is lambda? So this is something very general. You see, it doesn't depend on what is T and the fact that it's a spin model. But the main message is that we had our transfer matrix T. It had two eigenvalues, lambda plus and lambda minus. This one, the largest one, dominates the partition function. But the subleading one is also important because lambda minus over lambda plus are related to the correlation length of my system. Right? And that's a general lesson. You give me any model that has a transfer matrix, largest eigenvalue will dominate, but subleading eigenvalue will tell you about correlation lengths by exactly these traits. Now, we know what lambda plus and lambda minus is, so let's check. Compute what is lambda minus over lambda plus for when h is equal to 0. Is tangent, right? So in that case, we reproduce exactly what we expect. This becomes minus, when h equal to 0, minus log of v, where v is tangent of j, which is another check, because this is what we had reproduced there. Okay. Okay, and another check we can do is to compute this magnetization. We just compute these eigenvalues, you compute S, and you find that this magnetization is equal. I'm going to just write the result to sinh of JH over square root of cosh square of h plus e to the 2j minus 1. Okay. That's the result of the magnetization. And in particular, when h is equal to 0, it's equal to 0 as we saw before. Okay? Any question here? So that's just the result of computing this. Let me tell you another way of getting the same magnetization, which is much simpler, actually. If you just care about the magnetization, there is a much faster way of getting it, which is just by noticing. Let's find another shortcut of getting this magnetization. What is the magnetization? The magnetization is just 1 over L, right, times the expectation value of the sum over I over SI. And what can I do to my partition function to bring down this sum from the exponent? In the exponent, remember that this sum appears multiplied by h. So this is nothing but 1 over L, derivative with respect to h, of logarithm of my partition function. Why logarithm? Because then I take derivative and I get z prime over z, but that's what I want to do, right? Because z prime brings down the sum and I want to divide by z to have a normalized expectation value. But this z is lambda plus 2dl, so that when I take the log, the L cancels the L, so this is equal to derivative with respect to h of logarithm of lambda plus. So you can just take lambda plus that we computed, take derivative, and you get this. Okay, it's a check that we did no mistake. Okay. Okay, so now, so this is the solution of the Ising model. Whatever you want to compute, you compute now, right? I mean, if you want many spins, you just put transfer matrix with many S matrices in the middle. Now you can compute whatever you want, right? So this is like the brute force solution. So now let's think from an RG point of view. Let's try to recover some of these results and interpret a little bit these results from an RG point of view. Okay. So this is it. There is this two eigenvalues. Okay. Okay. Let's see. There's something else I want to do? No. So first let me, I'll be fast here because this was an exercise that we gave you, right? So did everyone do this exercise? I think Tibra distributed this exercise, right? So who did this exercise? Who did not do the exercise? Okay, so a few people didn't do, so I think I'll do it. The exercise was just start with the Ising model with magnetic field and do this business of integrating out the even spin and get some effective Hamiltonian for the odd spin. Okay, let's do it. So what we want to do is we want to integrate out S2, S4, and so on. So for example, let's look at this S2. So we have the summation over S2 E to the J S1, S2 plus S2, S3 plus H S1 plus S2 over 2 plus S2 plus S3 over 2. So, and we have this interaction and we integrate out 2. Now, after I integrate out, right, I can compute this. This is linear in S2, so it's very easy to compute, right? It's linear in S2. So I do the sum and I get just twice cosh of what multiplies S2. So it is J S1 plus S3 plus H times this term E to the S1 plus S3 over 2 times H. Okay, good. So now, look, I add this interaction between spin 1 and 2 and 2 and 3. I integrate out and I get this interaction between 1 and 3. This one is in a nice form to be recognized because this looks like 1 with magnetic field H, 3 with magnetic field H. But this term doesn't look like the original one. But now look, how many values can this term take? How many values can it take? If the spins are different, this is just one value, right? Because then it doesn't matter. 1 minus 1 minus 1, 1. So one value if they are different. And if they are the same, well, if they are the same, now it matters because of the magnetic field. If they are both 1, it gives one thing. If they are both minus 1, it gives another thing. So there are 3 values in total, right? So this function now, this guy here, can take 3 values. And therefore, we can say that this is equal to A e to the B S1 S3 plus C S1 plus S3 over 2. Right? Because this now also takes 3 values. And I just use and I fix now the constant A, B, and C. Okay, so this is equal to this. Where this constant, this full thing is equal to this full thing, where this constant here is what I would call J prime, and this constant is what I would call H prime. Right? The coupling after I integrate out 2, the magnetic field after I integrate out 2. Okay, let's compute it. So how do we compute it? We match these expressions for various values. So let's example. If everyone is 1, if everyone is 1, I get on the second line A e to the B plus C equal, first line, if everyone is 1, to E to the H times cosh times 2 cosh of 2J plus H. If everyone is minus 1, A E to the B minus C equal E to the minus H, right here, and both minus 1, 2, cosh of minus 2J plus H. And finally, if 1 is 1 and 1 is minus 1, A E to the minus B equal 1 is 1, 1 is minus 1, nothing here, and then just 2 cosh of H. Right? Now, we can solve for A, B, and C. A, I don't care, because A is normalization, but I care about B and C, which are J and J prime. So let me write the result, and you tell me if you agree. So let's say we want to get C. C is the ratio of this over this. right? I take this, I divide by this, and I get e to the 2c, right? So e to the 2c is equal to this, which is equal to this over this. So I get c equal to h plus something. C was h prime, so I get h prime equal to h, this over this, plus 1/2 logarithm of cosh of 2j plus h over cosh of 2j minus h. And if I want to get b, I want to get rid of c, so I multiply these two. If I multiply these two, I get a square. I want to cancel a square. I divide by the square of this last one. So I get that j prime equal, but then I get a power 4, so 1/4 of logarithm of cosh of 2j plus h times cosh of minus 2j plus h divided by cosh square of h. Right? Okay, good. So it means that I start with the j and then h, and I apply this transformation several times, and I go to j prime, h prime, and so on. Right? Now, you can easily analyze the fixed points. Let me tell you what the result is for the fixed points. So now, let's plot here. Let me plot tangent of j, because then it goes naturally from 0 to 1. That's a nice variable before. And here, let me plot magnetic field h. Right? So when h is 0, we know what happens, right? When h is 0, this is the RG flow. I just go here, and I have a stable fixed point here, and an unstable fixed point here. Let's check that this is okay. H is equal to 0. I put here h equal to 0. This is 1. This becomes cosh square of 2j. This is j prime. Okay, you don't recognize this in the form v equal v prime, v square, but it is. Okay. You have to trust me. But you can see that, by convexity, right? So you can see that j prime is becomes cosh square, so it becomes j. And what remains is negative, so it decreases a bit. It decreases a bit j. Because what remains is a 1 plus, 1 minus, no. And h is 0, it's the same as before. You can check, you can trust me. Okay? And what about, what about other fixed points? What are the other fixed points? The other fixed points is, let's see, where is it? So another fixed point, you see, is j equal to 0. Then it works in the sense that when j equal to 0, for any h prime, this is a fixed point. Because when I put here 0, and I put here 0 and 0, indeed, cosh square cancels cosh square, and log of 1 is 0, so I get 0 equals 0. It works for any h. And here, if I put any h equal to any h, and when this is 0, indeed, this is 1. So for any h, if I start with j equal to 0, and I start with some h, I have here a line of fixed points. Right? And that makes sense. It's saying that if I am totally decoupled, and right, and I just have some spin at side I, right, which are decoupled, of course I coarse grain, and I just get rid of the ones I don't see, and I continue with the same magnetic field there on the ones that I don't integrate out. But then what happens is, if you start anywhere here, you start here, and you start applying these transformations, and you go, and you flow to some value on this line. So you start with some j and h, and you flow here to 0 and some fixed h star. And that means that as I zoom out, effectively, my spins are becoming uncorrelated. My coupling between them is becoming uncorrelated. And what I get is a system of uncorrelated spins at some effective magnetic field H star. Right? Now it's fun because this is the picture that we get. And it should be easy to compute H star, right? You should just be able to solve these equations and compute H star. I don't know how to do it. But I know what the result is, and we know what the result is. But it's fun that such simple mathematical problem, right? Again, what I'm doing is just you take this J, you get J prime H prime, then you get J prime prime H prime prime by applying each transformation each time. And eventually, you go to a fixed point. With some effective magnetic field, right? Now, it's a very simple mathematical problem, right? Just apply many times and find what H star is, right?
So it seems that H star always bigger than H zero. Instead, because
now the way I wrote it, it's small. Maybe it's bigger. Yeah, maybe it's bigger.
Because H prime is equal to H plus a
positive. Well, something that's but yeah. Okay, so this line. Yeah, this might not be realistic. This might be up here. But it goes to some constant value here. And in principle, we should be able to compute it. So now in the exercise, I told you, start with some value. For example, in the exercise, I told you, start with 1/2, 1/3. And I gave you what this value is with like 20 digits, right? And so I know what the result is. I don't know how to show it from this point of view of iterating the RG. But we can get what this value is, what this H star is. Okay. So what is this H star? What is this fixed value H star as function of J and H? Right? Any guesses? How would we go about guessing this value? I mean, guessing or deriving, because we know. Yeah.
It'd be something with the mean field created by my spins that create something that is adding to the field I have. And so
that's in the right direction. So what's your name?
Remy.
Remy? So Remy is saying that the effect of integrating out fields is effectively generating some kind of background field, right? That's true, right? We start with some magnetic field, we integrate the things out, now we get another magnetic field. So it's indeed the effect of integrating out generated this field. And that makes sense, right? Because you are here and you have two neighboring spins, and the two neighboring spins themselves, the coupling to you looks like a magnetic field. Right, because you are here S2 and you interact with S1 and with S3 like the magnetic field. You feel their magnetic field. So if they by themselves have some preference to be slightly plus, then I feel a slightly plus magnetic field. And then if I integrate them out, I'm slightly plus and I back react on my neighbor again. And this iteration generates a net effect that changes my magnetic field. So that's what's happening. Indeed. Now, mathematically, how do I go about computing this H star? This still doesn't tell me. So. Any proposal? What are we saying? Yes.
So could we draw an analogy with quantum field theory and find some differential equation for J and H?
Not really. So a theory is some differential equation. So you see that this flow is very strongly coupled in the sense that we start really with some value very far away, or the one final way. Now, what you can do is, if you are close to fixed points, then under your iteration, you are almost not changing, right? Because you iterate and you are close. So close to fixed points, yes, we can expand the RG flow and derive some kind of perturbative equation close to the fixed point that we could be some differential equation. But this is really the full flow. I start with some JH, and I go the full flow, non-perturbative, until the perturbative regime, and I go to some fixed point at some H star. So it means that my system, from far away, I start with a system where spins interact, and I zoom out, and now I compute the same correlation function that I wanted to compute, and it's now described by a system where they don't interact, but they have an effective magnetic field that is different. But it's the same physics. So this is a hint.
If we're looking for a fixed point, can we not set H prime equals H and J prime equals J? Or we know already that.
But the point is that it doesn't work. Because H prime equal H, as I said, that's what we did by head, right? We said that when H prime equal to H and J equal to zero, it works. Just goes through the equation. So it doesn't tell you what H is, right? H equal to H prime, indeed, H equal H, they cancel, this is zero, it works, right? This is just saying that it is a fixed point. But to know what is the fixed point, you really need to know the starting point and follow it, right? You start with a different value, and you go to a different value, right? So it really depends, this chase, the final magnetic field depends where you start.
Right? Derivative with respect to some function and set it equal to zero because it is a stationary point, wouldn't that work?
That again will just tell you about the behavior here. It doesn't know about the full flow.
But we only need the fixed point, right?
We only need a fixed point, but the fixed point is a position of the initial point very far away, right? Like you have a differential equation and you start here, and depending on your initial conditions, you go to some point in the room. You cannot go to that point and expand around. You really need to know the full path all the way to the origin to know how you have to shoot.
Can we think about transfer matrix? Yes. Transfer matrix. Okay, you calculate the fixed point.
Transfer matrix to calculate a fixed point. If what you want to say is that perhaps the result is in the blackboard already, the answer is yes.
Then you can just take the function of H star of JH as a smooth function over the smooth plane, or the between J equal to zero and J equal to one. The boundary condition for J for H equal to zero. H and J and engine J, and then maybe there is something like a PD, and then
maybe let me try to say what you are saying. Maybe it's what you are saying or not. I think what you are saying is that I have H. I start with H, right, and I go to H prime of H. Let me ignore J, but there is J as well. And then this goes to H prime of H prime of H, which goes to H prime of H prime of H prime of H. And we could look for a pattern until this goes to H star, right? And try to find some kind of recursion relation from here to here or something like that. So that I could not do it. I tried to do it and I did not succeed. That sounds possible but hard. I don't know how to do it in practice. That's what it is doing, right? You iterate, and you go to H star, and these are the equations, right? You don't need to look anywhere. It's just these two equations doing that. Yes?
Maybe we have something that is conserved, like we have the same thing along the...
Good. What would that be?
I don't know if the magnetization would be the same.
Excellent. That's a physical quantity, yeah. Right? I can compute a physical quantity directly, microscopically, or at any moment, right? I integrate things out, it's the same physical system. So let's do that. Right? So let's do that. Let's compute the magnetization. Okay? So at the end, we have J star equal to zero. And therefore, my model is just a model of decoupled spins. Let me erase the connection between the spins. There are no connections, so J star is zero. So that's what I represent by empty. And at each spin, there is some effective spin H star, right? So what's my magnetization? My magnetization is just each site is decoupled, so I can take one site only. And it is just the sum of e to the h star times the spin s over the sum over the spin e to the h star s times s. Right? So it is just sinh over cosh. So this is just tangent of h star. Right? And so the answer is that this expression here is equal to tangent of h star. So h star is arctangent of this business here, because that's the magnetization. And indeed, you can check. You can take h equal 1/2, j equal 1/3, like in the exercise. You get 0.87 here. And you do the RG 10 times, and you go exactly to 0.87. But how to prove it directly from the RG, I don't know. It's a fun problem. Probably there is some discrete integrable model, like some evolution, like RG steps. Maybe we can find some nice mathematical structure and solve this problem directly. But that's the solution, right? So at the end, I have a system that has some effective magnetic field. My magnetization is therefore just tangent of that magnetic field. But on the other hand, I know what the magnetization is. I computed it from first principles, from the microscopic model, and it was that. And so this gives me a direction between the effective magnetic field and the microscopic parameters that I started with. Right? So that's the connection we would be after. Okay, so that's the picture of the RG. So I have 5 minutes more. Is it true, or am I over time? I have 5 minutes.
Yeah.
So any question here? So in this remaining 5 minutes, I just want to show you, to tell you something about the two-dimensionalizing model. Which is, let's suppose we start with a 2D Ising model in that language there of sticks. Then what is manifestly obvious is that I start with my Ising model in two dimensions, right? Where this is I, this is J, and that's an example of a neighbor IJ. And then at each position, I can have spin up or spin down, right? So I have spins up or down. Right? And this is just equivalent to this summation over sticks, right? Because there's nothing about one dimension here, right? And I just look at the, this is equal, the summation over such configurations is equal to a summation over configurations where now for each link I choose, let me draw more, where for each link I choose if there is a stick or not. Okay. But now let's draw one. So this, for example, would be an example. This is an example. And this one, each spin appears twice. So this result is non-zero because there are no endpoints, right? And another result that is not zero, but now I can have more than one. So I can have something like this, right? That's another That's another part. So I get that this partition function up to some normalization is equal to this, where this weight is what? Is v to the number of sticks, exactly the same thing. And then one if there are no open ends, and zero otherwise. Right? And therefore, this is a gas of sticks, right? With no open ends, right? That's the kind of duality we said. We can describe either spins up or down, or go directly to this stick language. And whenever I have an open end, I get zero. But if I don't have an open end, I get just one V per each link, right? And I want to say that this is almost the partition function for a gas of closed paths. Okay, I want to put an equal sign. Right? Because I just look at here and this looks like two closed paths. Right? So it looks like this could almost work. But this, as it is, it's not true. It's almost true. Right? But let's see why this would not be true, because here, for this example, here it's perfect. This is a perfect example. Here it would work. Indeed, I just have two paths, and each path comes with its own length, and it's all good. But this almost would come because let's be more careful and think, for example, of, say, a configuration like this, where here is one set of sticks, and here is another set of sticks. Now, this is one configuration of sticks. So what's the weight for this configuration? It's just one times v to the length, right? So this is just v to the length of this eight shape, which, okay, in this case, it's the length is eight. So, but it's v to the eight times. But what's important is that it's times one. It's one configuration, right? But what is this in terms of paths? In terms of paths, is it equal to this path, these two paths, or is it equal to this path, or would it be equal to this path? Right? So it looks like if I do sum over paths, as soon as they are far away, it's all good. I just have a path here, a path there, it's fine. But then when I go into the details, here I have one, and here naively I get one path, another path, another path, which is equal to three. Right? And three is not working, because three is not one. Right? So if I sum over paths, it's not this is not ideal. And so the idea, how could we convert this 1 plus 1 plus 1, which is 3, into 1? How do you convert 1 plus 1 plus 1 into 1? What could you do to this mathematical equality to get the 1 here? Divide by 3 is an idea. But I want to get the 1. What would I do to get the 1?
Make a class of equivalence. Say that it's modulo 3. Like,
yeah, but then it becomes very hard to deal with. Because if you start, I sum over paths, model some equivalences, and so on, then it's true, of course, but it's not going to be useful. Then it's going back to sticks. It's like saying all that matters are sticks. It's not paths. But if I really want to have a path, because a path is some kind of Markovian process, and it's nicer than just putting sticks, I have to transform somehow this.
Make a 1, a minus 1.
No, but come on, Ivan. No, you are in the lectures. Right? So one idea you could do is flip some sign. Right?
Introduce orientation.
Exactly. And so the idea is, look, this guy has this guy has some wrapping, and this one has no winding. Namely, if I take my vector and I go like this, but then I go like this, and this guy doesn't wind, but this guy winds. So if somehow this has winding one, this one has winding zero, and these guys are two guys with winding one. So this is like winding one square. Right? So if we say that we get some kind of minus one to the winding, this would be one, this would be one, but then this would be minus one. Right? And so the idea is that indeed it's a gauze of closed paths where orientation matters. And so in the next lectures, so next, we will start first usual walks, and then second, we will see that these usual walks are related to some Ising model, which is not this, but what's called the Gaussian Ising model. And then we will add orientation to these walks, and then we will come back to the Ising model and we will solve, armed with this new technique, the two-dimensional Ising model. Okay? So that's the plan for the next four, maybe five lectures. Okay? So that's where we are heading now. Okay, so that's the spoiler. Yeah. Okay.